General Duncan, Reel 8. We move on to the 2nd Battalion RTC, which you were posted to.
When I came home, I was on sick leave for a year.
Yes.
I then asked General Hubbard if I could come to the 2nd Battalion. And after some hesitation, he agreed.
Do you mean you kind of selected the 2nd Battalion for yourself?
No, I got an exchange. Somebody wanted to go to Indo, and he was prepared to go in my place, and he came from the 2nd Battalion. So as I went to General Hobo and said, can I come to your battalion? And that was the beginning of one of the most fruitful and happy associations I've ever had.
This was actually your first appointment to a tank battalion.
To a tank battalion, that's right.
After 12 years in the Corps.
After 12 years in the Corps, yes. Very odd, isn't it?
Isn't it? How did you greet the posting? How did you greet the posting when you eventually got it?
I was delighted. Well, it kept me at home. I wasn't bothered about the tank. I mean, by that time I knew enough. I knew enough to deal with the tank mechanically. There were any number of officers that were close personal friends of mine. But the tank mechanically, that was quite a different story. I always remember waiting for my first inspection and seeing this cortege arrive, army officer, regimental sergeant major, the bugler, the orderly officer, the field officer of the day, and so on. It was trembling in my shoes, but I really knew very little about the actual details of the tank. I watched the cortege turn off into the pioneer shop, and as I'd been given the pioneer shop, I thought I'd go and see what happened. I found the CO paying absolute havoc, and, cursing everybody right and left. He eventually arrived at a carpenter, who was a great friend of mine, who I'd known as a boy in the depot, to whom I had given a particularly intricate joint to do. And I was stamping up, now what the hell's all this? It was a waste of time, all we want a dab of glue and a couple of nails, and I thought, well, hell. I pushed my way forward and said, are you a practical carpenter? And he said, no. And I said, I am, and that's the way to do this job. And he walked out, outside minor brawls. I never really had any trouble with him again.
What was he like to work with?
I suppose you would say absolute hell. I mean, he demanded absolute impossibilities, and drove you as hard as he drove himself. As long as you were prepared to stand up to him, he was delightful in the mess. He was delightful. He talked to you in a way that no other commanding officer that I'd ever had, except Jumbo, Hope ever did. What's the choice of more? He probed at you. Why did you say this? What a nonsensical statement. What grounds you justify this? And you jolly well had to justify it. As you know, he was a fanatic on the use of the tank. Trouble was, of course, you never knew when the Etna wasn't going to explode under your feet. And it exploded, jolly well did. I can remember time and time and time again when really the most appalling explosions of wrath took place.
Give me some examples.
I don't know. Again, I don't really know that I can. I can always the one that always made me laugh so much. I was sent out to do a demonstration to a platoon of a company, I think, of Royal Scots. I was told to knock down trees, which I hated doing anyhow, to show what the tank would do in the country. And so I knocked down a small tree, and I knocked down another tree. And the hill said, well, it was a decent sized tree. Take that tree there. It was like a pine, about that big. So I told his driver to reverse and knock the tree down. And he hit his most almighty wallop, and he wobbled, and he stood up. He reversed and hit it again. He reversed and hit it again. He was still standing up. Hobo went off a deep end. I thought that was the way he was going to have officers behaving like. When he said knock the tree down, he better well meant knock the tree down and down forthwith. If I couldn't have been there, I could go away. I wasn't any bloody good to him. I had no determination, and I was quite incapable of training my men. Or I could take my bloody tank home to barracks. And having this, all this in front of the infantry, having reduced me to apparent immobility, I saluted smartly, backed the tank back, and the taproot, which had been underneath the tank, grow free, and the tree fell down. One of the few times I've seen her was slightly disconcerted. I saluted and got in the tank, drove on. But
were there any other such events that are memorable?
Oh, those sort of things. Yes, there were dozens of them. It was a frightful time when I came down to Lulworth. I was left to bring company on my first long march. I moved them much too fast. Our average was absolutely staggering. The medium tank we should drive was about 12 miles an hour. I've forgotten, when I was temporarily in charge, I achieved some incredible average rate, around about 18 or 20 miles an hour. Paid for it, we couldn't start our firing practices lower, because all the bogies fell off as a result, they were overstressed. That didn't make me very popular. And oddly enough, that was almost duplicated word for word when I was a brigade commander commanding the 30th Armored Brigade in France, because I was going to be left behind at Le Havre, and I didn't see much fun in that, and so I went to Havre and said, well, there are no transporters, we'll get on our own tracks. I guarantee the brigade will only do 12 miles an hour. We can do this quite easily. And I'd stolen the petrol from another brigade, and so we started off. Unfortunately, my damn CO disregarded that. They averaged somewhere around about 25. We did in 165 bogey wheels. Mercifully, we found an American Army tank dump and got 165 wheels and put them on again. Nobody ever knew. But the circumstances were exactly the same. Outside there, you were continually being tested, you see. He was frightfully good. He was a very good trainer, wonderful trainer. He was the first man, really, who brought home to the 2nd Battalion and later to the Tank Brigade the real meaning of war. Now, this is a very interesting fact, I think. I kept on saying to chaps who'd served in the war, what's it like to be shot at? What do you feel like? What have I got to guard against? When I see a man killed, what reaction does it have on me? What do you do when you go over to his country and somebody fires at you? Well, nobody had ever given me a really collective answer to that. Jumbo was quite good, but he was so physically brave himself that he made light of it. He didn't really tell you what you had to guard against. But I always remember the first year I was there, 32, 33, Hobo ran an exercise up a village called Dummer, now Basingstoke. And this was the first time that I began really to realize what armored warfare or tank warfare was going to be like. I can remember to this day the way the vividness of the picture that was painted, which brought you up in a round turn and a couple of half hitches. I mean, it's been great fun swanning around the countryside and that sort of thing. But when you began to work that out in the question of the danger and the responsibility which fell on you, not to save your own life, but to get the show through, get the show through fast, because your objective wasn't situated 300 yards away, it was 15 miles in the back. And it was an absolute eye-opener to me, it was an eye-opener to the 2nd Battalion as well. And from then on, the Corps was very smartly divided between those who advocated independent action around the back and those who reckoned that the real role of the Tank Corps was close support of the infantry as it had been in the First World War. Interestingly, I was working on the Russians, who faced exactly the same problem. The difference between the two being that the Russians laid down a definite tactical role and allotted a definite portion of their forces to that row and that one, then we who have never said the object of the tank is either to do that or to do that. And this has never been really said. It's been tacitly acknowledged.
Yeah. Let's leave Russia and go back to Farnborough.
That comes back.
Yeah. We had an interesting aside about Hobo, but let's start off at first principles. What was the setup at Farnborough when you went there in terms of facilities, equipment, machines?
We had the Vickers Mark I, Vickers Medium Tank Mark I. The organisation were three companies. There was no headquarter company. Wait a minute. They were mixed companies consisting of light tanks and medium tanks. There was a medium tank section of five tanks in each company, and there was a light tank section of seven light tanks. I will check.
Which section were you attached to?
I had the medium section, for which I may say I was very thankful, because the early light tanks were so small that I had great difficulty in getting into them.
Mm-hmm.
The light tanks were a very mixed bag. They were only just coming out. We had a very experimental batch. We had some with Rolls-Royce engines and some with Hillman engines, and there were two floating tanks which didn't float because they'd been badly designed, and that sort of thing. It was a very scratch affair. But in 1933, we went down to the plain for 6 weeks. This was 6 weeks hard on the plain. No wives allowed. No weekend leave if your tank didn't go. If a tank crew had a tank which was off the road, not in workshops, they had no leave until it was on the road. And the section commander and the company commander had no leave. So that your maintenance went up by leaps and bounds. It really did go up.
Why are you singling this 33 exercise out for comment?
I'm thinking that particular exercise, well, this is slightly jumbled, but when we got down to the plan, they extemporized a light reconnaissance battalion for the three battalions of the brigade. And they did that by taking the light companies away, the light sections away from the companies, and making them into a composite reconnaissance battalion, which was extremely successful. This really followed on an organization which had been drawn out in 1931-32 for the tank brigade, for the handling of the mass of the tank brigade. This was done by General Broad, Charles Broad, and it was worked out in most elaborate form, the principle being that the reconnaissance of the area where the strike was to fall was carried out by the commanding officer and his own company commanders in their own tanks, while the mass of the brigade itself was led on by the field officer and brigade waiting, who was senior major detailed for that purpose, until the reconnaissance had been finished and the plan had been drawn out by the commanding officer, when commanding officers wireless their own battalions, where to meet them. And it was rather a stirring sight to see COs coming back and falling in at the head of their own battalion, actually on the move. The speed of the issue of orders was absolutely unbelievable, because you see, it meant that you put the whole tank brigade into an attack in 10 minutes. 10 minutes it took on the reconnaissance. And you really had to go back and join your battalion, which was on the way, and you were in the attack. The attack was in 40 minutes, easily, as against 2.5 to 3 hours Our people drew maps and issued operation orders and formed their groups and went back on feet, on their feet and that sort of thing.
Mm.
This was really the outstanding example of the speed and the flexibility. And what was the first, aided and abetted, of course, by Wallace, which he developed to a very high degree.
Yeah.
Wallace was a nightmare in those days. It really was. It had a set called an MBMC set. The MBMC set used to get its high tension voltage, 250 volts, by 125 cells which were draped around the inside of the tank. If you hit a real decent bump, the whole bloody lot came adrift, and acid and cells and God knows what else dripped down your neck. That was a year later that was improved by the rotary converter, but the wireless, the extreme attention was paid that year to wireless discipline. And what is much, much more, he also introduced another innovation. At the end of an exercise, the whole brigade, all four battalions, were lined up on the hillside. The stage was set by his brigade major or somebody. And then the performance of people in the battalion was criticized unmercifully. I can remember being personally flayed alive by some bloody stupid company commander, Berger, stand up. So I stood up among the whole lot. I was then told what a bloody fool I was. Interesting thing was that he didn't, it's normally considered the crime of crimes. There were a great many laughs. I was heartily laughed at. It didn't make any difference between my relationship between myself and my men. And I took bloody good care not to do it again. I thought I did.
This is the first day of brigade drill in 33.
This was in 33, yes. I was taken out for brigade drill under the brigade commander by Wireless. Wireless wasn't terribly reliable, but we started off in line ahead. We then formed two up, we then formed three up, and we then advanced in three up. And I was the middle company of the whole bloody lot, and everybody was converging in on me, and there was nothing you could do about it. Mercifully, we did share off in sufficient time, but it was an unnerving experience, but a most interesting and exhilarating one, because this was the first time we'd seen something like 150, 200 tanks manoeuvring as a mass under one man, and it was extremely successful. We took an area of country about 6 miles by 6 miles, and we went down that in one direction. We turned to the left. And we then broke formation, one formation, and dispersed and came back again. And as far as I was concerned, it was an absolute eye-opener. And you got to the stage, really, of course, before you got onto this brigade training, you'd been down on the plane as a, first of all, for troop training and then for company training. And both those two, you went at absolutely continually until officers and men and tank crews were organized to the extent that you could control a troop with one finger like that.
Now let's take you back to your appointment as section officer of the medium tank battalion of 2nd Battalion RTC. I'm interested in the routine training programs of the battalion during this 3-year stint you had with it, particularly from the point of view that you'd had a lot to do with training, particularly in the depot at Bovington, but now you are on the receiving end rather than the giving end of it. So can you tell me first of all about how the training was organized throughout the year, from the smallest component training up to the biggest unit training?
The training season started in October. Hobo used to have things which drove one almost mad. You had a training chart for on which was displayed every man in the company, and it worked out. He set up in the battalion training schools, driving school, gunnery school, wireless school, anything else which might occur to him. A clerk school, a DR's school, a DR section of the battalion school. And every man on every man in the company was marked down to a certain number of these courses. The various colours were used, and it was halved, and as he finished his course, it was completed. And this was under constant revision by the commanding officer. When I say constant revision, I mean constant revision. And from October, you started, October to February or March, was entirely given up to individual training, and this included your pistol course, gas course, foot drill course if necessary, NCOs, CADA courses, all those sort of things. And by the time March came round, the battalion school was broken up, the officers and NCOs who had been running it came back to their companies. They were instructors by virtue of the courses which they'd done at Bovington in one of the schools there. So that at the end of March, there was your company individually trained. And then started the next great wrangle, which was the allocation between section training, company training, battalion training, and brigade training. Homer was very good about this. He was a great believer in allowing you to train your own men. And therefore, as a section commander, you were confronted with probably 6 weeks. 1 week devoted to crew training, and the remaining 5 weeks devoted to troop training. Superimposed on that, battalion scheme, battalion exercises, like what I told about the Dummer defile, which is 1 day a week. And then, of course, in addition to that, you had the ordinary awful things like court-martials and so on and so forth. Courts of inquiry, audit boards, the usual clutter of regimental stuff. If you then settled down to make out your own training program to cover the 5 weeks that you've been given. And your first week of crew training, your aim was to make quite certain that every member of the crew was fit to take over any other man's duties. And that included all sorts of things. Driving, you did the driving, you did the gunnery, the loader was exercised. We had a crew of five men. So we had and you had two machine guns, three machine guns in the tank, and the main gun. And you exercised your men at the weapons continually, literally, day in and day out. And the moment you got them more or less proficient in one job, you sort them all over and started all over again. At the end of the week, you rubbed up their map reading as well. You might have done a little foot drill, very unlikely, but under company arrangements and that sort of thing. So when you were at the end of the week, your chaps were fit to undertake any exercise, and then you started on the actual section training. And I was always a great believer. I set them down the attacks that I was going to do, the method of attack. Which, broadly speaking, was straight ahead, the right flank attack, the left flank attack, or a combined attack. And I used to draw out the attack on a blackboard, and we would then go out on foot. This was most unpopular, so I didn't like it at all, to a bit of country that I'd had a look at, and we then walked the course. Two or three chaps would be taken out of the section and set up on top of the hill with flags, and they raised flags whenever they saw sight or sound of a chap appearing. It did, the thing it taught two things. One, it taught us to move jolly quickly. You see, from the time you set up a signal, because wireless was primitive in those days, we also had a battalion signal card which used five flags, TWRINK they were, in actual fact, along that way and along that way. If you put up the red flag by itself, which gave the diagonal signal, it meant go forward, and the blue flag meant go back, and there were five single flag signals. And then a combination of the two would tell you to do right flank attack or left flank attack, or to go straight ahead, or to retire or withdraw, or to harbour, that sort of thing. After you walked the course to satisfaction, then went back and got into your tanks and went and drove the course in exactly the same way, chaps out with flags, to make quite sure the moment the tank turret showed, a flag went up and everybody then stopped, and the offender was criticised with all the other crews. This was started off within very slow motion on a very small piece of ground. After you reckoned that they'd got the left flank attack satisfactory, you went out and did it in rather more extended ground, and you then went on next day to the same sort of thing. The harbouring procedure, we used to go into harbour, which was tuck all the tanks away from sight, tuck them away in a defensive position, tuck them away so in two bits or in to cover ground. Every combination that you could possibly think of, any form of military operation, and when you got bored with doing it with your own chaps, you went and did it with a troop next door, two troops. You said to your fellow company commander or section commander, I bet you we will never see my chaps move over this bit of country, and run it as a contest. And while you were doing that, you also did all the track changing and that sort of thing, and worked up for the tank proficiency competitions as well. This was all rather stimulating. We used to have a cock company. They were there was a competition was run between the companies, which included certain speed tests, movement, taking a gun to pieces and putting it back again, changing a track, and so that all that sort of thing. And then at the end of your 6 weeks, if you'd done the stuff properly, you had a properly trained troop, and you then went on to do the first of the company training with the two sections, and probably with two companies as well, two company commanders who take command of the of the combined two companies. It was very, very much once you got out of the original day, the original troop training, the original crew training, which was quite clear. The rest of it was very, very largely left to your own imagination. There were no manuals. I mean, the manual wasn't any help to you, really, when you came to do an exercise. And in that, I always felt we were compared very unfavorably with the German army, who set a series of six or seven exercises at company level and at regimental level, which both the company and the regiment had to do before they were allowed to go into war. This is very much on the lines of the Navy working up exercises, and I've tried for years to get this introduced into the Army with complete failure.
Tell me a bit about the larger unit training, the battalion training.
Well, the battalion training was, again, on exactly the same thing. You moved down the road one up, And you then extended into two. You did an attack on a position. You brought the third company in one side or the other. You were then left to dominate the position, to hold a line. One company would be sent off from one side or to the other side to do some job. Again, entirely with the idea of making the thing flexible under the command at hand, which were after the whole time, which was something which would work almost as a snap of the finger.
Mm.
And basically speaking, you've got it. And of course, the other thing too was the continual insistence on speed.
You were saying that with the larger unit training, there was this great emphasis on speed.
Yes, there was. After all, Homer always had in his mind, he had the fastest, most flexible, the hardest hitting unit under his command. And it suited me down to, it amused me to train my chaps to move as fast as they possibly could.
Within all of these intensive training programs,